The light went green for me. All right, let's get started. So we're here, we're going to talk about an overview of Windows Azure Active Directory and how identity management sits in that. I'm Ross Adams, I'm a PM, I work in the Windows Azure Active Directory team.
And I'm John O'Lock, I'm also a program manager with the Azure AD team.
And we're going to walk you through what we've got. So first of all, we'll walk through what is Azure Active Directory for those who are unsure. We'll talk about directory sync, what's new, what are your options for directory integration, some common scenarios that come up, predominantly around multi-forest, how the sync works, and how single sign-on works. So firstly, what is a Windows Azure Active Directory? So a while back, we started off with Office 365. Who has an Office 365 subscription? Perfect. Then you all also have a Windows Azure Active Directory. And we wanted to make it as confusing as possible. So what we did was we built, at the same time we were building Office 365, we started building a core directory underneath that. That core directory we built underneath it, we didn't really give a name until more recently. And now we've given it a name, Windows Azure Active Directory. And we gave it a name for two reasons. One is that it obviously was a great directory for Office 365. It allowed us to scale at internet scale. It provided multi-tenancy, and it provided the Office applications a great platform to work from. And it also meant that we could take on-premise directories, so Active Directory being on-premise, and really allow us to integrate and project that into the cloud. So it's now what we had was a service, if you will. So we had an identity service that our Microsoft Cloud applications could use, and that you could use or integrate with your on-premise directory. So we kept building on that, and we gave it a name. And the reason we gave it that name of Windows Azure Active Directory was because it now can do more than just deal with Office 365 and Microsoft applications. You can build line of business applications against it that allow you to interact and use that directory in the cloud, just like Office does. So it's really a directory and identity as a service, either as an ISV, so whether you write applications that you want to on-sell to other Active Directory organizations, or if you want to build your own line of business apps in the cloud, you can use this Windows Azure Active Directory investment that you've already got through Office 365 to do that. Okay? And it's really about providing a nice, easily connectable, scalable platform for cloud-based applications. So that's sort of Windows Azure Directory in a nutshell. So what's new? What have we done, been working on since, I guess, the last tech ed? We've started support for non-ADFS SDSs. So previously, we always said, if you want to do federation, if you want to integrate your identity provider into Office 365 or Azure AD, you need to use ADFS. And more recently, we've branched out from there, and we've gone ahead and support for Shibboleth, Ping Federate, Optimal IDM, and there's a bunch of others coming. Okay. There are some feature gaps. All right. So Shibboleth, for example, doesn't support what we call the Microsoft Sign-In Assistant. Okay. And that Microsoft Sign-In Assistant is used by a number of different clients, Link being the predominant one, so the Link 2010-2013 client, as well as the Office subscription services. They all use this Sign-In Assistant. And unfortunately, Shibboleth doesn't support it. Shibboleth also requires what we call the ECP, the Enhanced Client Profile Pack, so that you can use it with Outlook, ActiveSync, IMAP, POP, and those sorts of clients. As another example, Ping Federate, and they're working on this, is that their Windows Integrated All story is something they're working on to try and get a complete integration story. But generally speaking, they support most of the scenarios. They also have some limits around client access filtering, and we'll talk about that in a little while. We also added, very recently, you would have seen some demos this week, on Azure Active Authentication. I'm going to talk a bit more about this, but it's effectively providing strong or multi-factor authentication in the cloud for cloud-based identities. And we'll walk through this later in the deck. We also have recently, I guess, in, when did we do it?
April?
April, somewhere in there. We announced the general availability of what we're calling the Azure Active Directory Graph API, or the Directory Graph API. And it's a RESTful API for programming against Azure AD. So if you write applications today that run on premises, that talk to AD, use things like LDAP and ADSI to get there. In the cloud, you use something that's RESTful. And the reason we do that is because it allows us to deal with all the different types of clients that live out there. So if it has a browser, it has the ability to get to the Azure AD. Right. You can also build multi-tenanted apps if you're an ISV. You can use the graph to be able to get to many tenants. And there's a session that was done earlier in the week by Ed Wu that walks through that.
All right, some other stuff that's new. We recently, actually, on Monday, announced password synchronizations available as part of DirSync. It's something we heard customers really wanted for a very long time. We're really happy to be able to roll that out. What that effectively does is it gives you an option between the my users are wholly in the cloud, but different username and password, and the true single sign-on solutions that we've traditionally had. And we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a couple slides. Something else is we're about to roll out a public beta of the Azure Active Directory connector for FIM 2010 R2. That can be used for multi-forest scenarios. So if you're a customer with multiple AD forests on-prem, you can deploy the FIM sync engine, put that connector in, and effectively populate your Azure AD tenancy, or Office 365, with that information using our connector. And so we expect to run a public beta for about 2 months, collect feedback, and then take that into production. That connector is the same technology we use in the regular DuraSync client, so it's already tried, tested, and true. It's more about the deployment experience on top of the FimSync engine and such. And that'll be available through the Connect site. And we are now supporting installation on Windows Server 2012 of DuraSync. And the new DuraSync that was released this week actually includes SQL Server 2012. So DuraSync, as well as FimSync engine 2010 R2, can both be running against SQL Server 2012 now. So that's been something we've been working on for a while to make sure we can give customers. So switching gears a bit, we said we'd talk about how to integrate, how to get your directory connected with Azure Active Directory, which ultimately gives you all that information for Office 365, Intune, CRM, and other custom applications. What we'll do is kind of walk through a couple of the solutions and show you the pros and cons, but it's really up to you to decide which is appropriate, what best meets your needs. Different customers obviously have different scenarios and requirements. And so what we're trying to do here in this slide is lay out the different pivots by which you can evaluate the options. And then the options are kind of your columns across. So real quick, just running down those rows, what we try to do is explain, you know, in terms of the customer segment, so there's considerations around performance, around the cost of having to do a particular action. So the target customer segment will sort of help you understand where you might fall. The second is what we call scenario supported. There's things like Exchange hybrid deployments. If you want cross-premises address book, free busy, things like the voicemail, you know, unified messaging. And so different options offer you different degrees of support for those. The directory source of authority is where you're going to manage your objects. In some cases, it's going to be in your on-prem AD. In other cases, it'll be directly in that cloud. Some of the solutions have additional hardware requirements. You might have to deploy additional servers, and we'll talk about that when we move into the DirSync and the SSO space for sure. IDP, your identity provider, this is where logins will actually happen. At the end of the day, it's either going to be in the cloud against the Windows Azure Active Directory authentication service or your on-premises Active Directory. The login experience, so we'll talk a little bit about sort of how you get prompted, what user, password, credentials, all that stuff. And the other piece is complexity, which is how hard is it to get it deployed and maintained? Complexity is kind of a nebulous concept because there's a couple different ways something can be easy or hard. So running across the options, the first one's the portal. So this is really for small customers. This is when you use the portal to manually enter your identities, you give them a display name, the UPN, and then you can give them licenses. There isn't a lot of support for the various sort of higher-end scenarios like cross-premises, mailbox migrations, some of the new features coming down the pipe from the Windows Server organization, as well as password sync. You can't synchronize your passwords in this option. There is no hardware required. You're just using the portal, the web portal, your internet browser. So no additional requirements there. The main thing here is your users are going to log in with usernames and passwords that aren't necessarily the same as what you have on-prem. So now they're using sticky notes, and they're having to remember those credentials because your complexity requirements might be different in the cloud and on-prem. And so now they're having to remember which one, where, when they expire, and all that. They'll have to enter their credentials twice, but at the end of the day, this is a low-complexity option. So if you just want to try something out, that may be your option. Moving to the next column is PowerShell and the directory graph. So as Ross mentioned, Ed talked about the graph this morning in a session, gives you programmatic access to the Azure Active Directory, create objects, manage objects, create things like address books, right? But in this particular scenario, we're talking about creating and managing those objects. So you can do this. You can write code, write your own application that ties in to the Azure AD through Graph. So you could obviously, you know, have that scale to be a fairly large solution. But the problem there is you don't get a lot of the higher tier sort of features and options. You don't get password sync, for example. And so that's why we've kind of called it small to medium. You know, some of those scenarios you might have as a customer are not supportable via the Graph or the PowerShell option. The source of authority is still cloud, meaning you would create and manage your objects in the cloud through the Graph, right? That's kind of that's why we say cloud in there. There's no additional hardware, realistically speaking. You can create your application, run it on an existing server, and you're all good. You are logging in against the cloud. Your users will be authenticating against the cloud in this case. And again, same type of experience as before. You'll have different usernames and passwords. They'll have to type their username and password twice. And the complexity is a little bit higher because you're writing code or you're doing something to automate the PowerShell. The last three columns are all DirSync, and they really differ in terms of the identity solution. So I'll kind of just run through these real quick. DirSync gives the ability to automate the population of information into Azure Active Directory or Office 365. You don't have to do it yourself. You set that application up, and it's going to keep everything in sync. So across all three columns, that's a constant in this case. The main thing about DirSync is it lights up a lot of those cross-premises or hybrid, depending on, you know, what feature you're looking at and then what they like to call it, those hybrid scenarios. So if you're looking at Exchange migrations, for example, you're a larger organization, and you want to take a little bit of time to migrate those mailboxes, your C-level folks can't go yet, your legal folks can't go yet, DirSync enables that scenario where you can transition mailboxes over time. And so that's why you sort of see this scenario supported. It moves from least to some limitations. In this particular case, what the DirSync with cloud identities and DirSync with password sync don't give you is true single sign-on. So that's why you see a difference in those columns. In the case where you're using DirSync, everything is managed in your on-premises directory. So if I want to change someone's display name because, you know, they got married, changing a last name, or department's changed, any of that information, you go to your on-prem AD, DirSync will move that into the cloud for you. So that's definitely something different in here. Your directory source of authority is on-premises. You do need more hardware. DirSync requires a Windows Server OS. We're working to actually support deployment in our domain controller. That should be coming sometime later this summer. The thing there is a double-edged sword. It's not a best practice to deploy SQL on a domain controller, but a lot of smaller customers who don't have the ability to spin up hardware, right? They just want to try something out. That's really the scenario where we think it's okay, you know, get going on that, and then we still recommend that you install it on a proper Windows Server OS that's not a domain controller for security purposes. So there's hardware required for DirSync. You're still logging in against the cloud if you're using cloud identities or password sync. If you're using SSO, and Ross will talk a lot more about this in a moment, you're actually going to be logging in against your on-premises Active Directory. That's what ADFS is going to be doing for you. And so we'll dive into that in a minute. In the case of cloud identities, they might have the same username. So for example, I might be joesmith@contoso.com, but my passwords will be different, like we said before, right? Different complexity requirements, different expiration windows. With password sync, you're now giving them the option to sign with the same password. When I go and update my password on-prem, it synchronizes the cloud. The same string is now used in both places, but you still have to enter your credentials twice. And in terms of complexity, DirSync on a whole is what we like to think, what I like to think, because I own it, is relatively low complexity. It's 10 screens, you click a couple times, and it's done. The last column with SSO, again, we'll dig into that more, we do say it's high complexity because of the infrastructure requirements for ADFS, and Ross can definitely speak to that a little bit more. Some of the common questions are, so just because you sync, you don't have to use or set up single sign-on. That's clearly an option now to use password sync instead of single sign-on if that meets your needs. However, if you're going to do single sign-on, we recommend that you run directory synchronization. There's a couple ways out there using PowerShell when you can get around using DirSync, but because DirSync is designed to move that information for you, set the state correctly in the directory, we recommend using DirSync. And the other thing here is, a lot of folks ask, you can control what objects sync into Azure AD. You can't change which attributes of those objects. So for example, we don't currently allow you to say, I don't want my user's department information to flow. You can say, I don't want these users to flow, but not you can't select subsets of information to go up to the cloud. A couple common topologies we see, and this is to hopefully help you guys understand as well, is a single 80 forest on-prem, if that's the case, with a single tenant in the cloud, just set up DirSync. And if you want to use a single sign-on solution, you can use ADFS or some of the third-party STSs that Ross talked about. If you have multiple 80 forests on-premises with a single tenant, then you can use the FIM connector that I mentioned earlier that's coming into public beta. There's a double asterisk behind there to do with exchange organizations. And in the next slide, I'll actually show you one case where customers that might have two forests aren't really going to have to use the connector. They can still use DirSync. But most common scenarios we see for multiple 80 forests, you'll want to deploy the connector. Again, ADFS or a third-party STS can be used in that situation. Something we just started supporting is if you have a single 80 forest in your on-premises environment, but you want to have multiple tenancies. An example might be I have regional offices, right? I have a North America office and a European office, and I want them to be different tenants in the cloud, but they're actually in a single forest. Or for schools, I have multiple campuses. They're in a single 80 forest on-premises, but I want each school to be their own tenant. I have a slide in about 2 seconds here where you can actually set up multiple instances of the DirSync appliance, one instance per tenant, and then segment that data out into multiple tenancies. That's something we literally just rolled out in the last week here. Finally, if you have non-Active Directory directories, you can definitely use the FIM connector. The FIM supports connectivity to a lot of non-Active Directory sources. And in the case where you have multiple 80 forests and multiple non-AD, then that, again, the connector is your story there. It gives you full flexibility to draw from those source directories and push that up into the cloud. Something just to note for the pieces where we kind of say there's multiple tenants that can be targets. The way that our identity platform works, the namespace, so the domain suffix of a UPN, can only be associated with a single tenant at a time. So if I have multiple tenancies, only one tenant could use acantoso.com, and another tenant could only use, and the other tenant would use adventureworks.com. You could not have two different tenants both using contoso.com. It confuses the platform because of the way we segment our information.
It's probably worthwhile noting that the same is true for a namespace. So if you have a namespace, contoso.com, it can only be associated with a single ADFS or a single STS. So you can't have contoso.com, part of the users go to one STS and part of the users go to another. All right, so just keep that in mind.
Yep.
I think I'm referencing this. So if you had subdomains too, you can actually, as long as you have the domain with the bulk domain switch, you can actually have, nova.contoso.com one tenant and asia.contoso.com another.
That's correct. So if you have, the question was, if I have contoso.com or sales.contoso.com in one tenant, can I have marketing.contoso.com in another tenant? And the answer is yes, because they're effectively different tenants. And different domains. We'll come to that one. The second part of the question was, can I use the same ADFS farm or the same STS for that? And the answer is yes. They need to use different issuer URIs, but yes, a single farm can be used with that. The third part of the question is, if I have contoso.com in one tenant and sales.contoso.com and marketing.contoso.com in that same tenant, the way that we manage this is we actually manage it such that contoso.com becomes the parent of those subdomains. So in this case, sales.contoso.com would inherit from the parent contoso.com. Thus, only one STS could be used with contoso.com. We're working on this, but as it stands today, if you actually register them, if you will, out of order, so if you register sales.contoso.com, then contoso.com, you can actually use different STSs for those two domains. But just it's a workaround to a problem that we're looking at addressing.
Not sure.
What about non-rootable UPNs, so like .local?
So the question is, if I have a non-routable UPN, it's not something that we can support in the cloud at all. And the reason that we don't support it in the cloud today is because you can't prove you own it. So we rely on internet-based DNS to be able to prove you own a domain. So we get you to create a text record to prove you own that domain. So if your on-premise directory is called, contoso.local or contoso.internal, it won't. You can't prove to the cloud that you own that domain. So we don't allow you to add it. It's not necessary, however, for you to rename your domain, your on-premise Active Directory domain. You can set UPNs. You can add alternative UPN suffixes, for example. and set it to something like their email address, and we will sync that into the cloud, and SSO will work, even though the AD domain is given a different name.
There's one over there.
There's lots of questions.
Oh, what the?
We've got a case of a child domain, and we're going with the email domain address at marker.edu for both the parent and child domain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Across the entire forest. Do you have any recommendations for that?
So, sorry, are you asking about discovering the ones that are not unique, or what's the particular?
PowerShell does a good job on discovering the non-unique ones, but it's ensuring uniqueness going forward that's my primary concern.
It's a good question on how do you ensure that the UPNs are unique? It is a difficult problem, and there's no probably easy solution to it other than, you know, sort of relying on SAM account name as being a means that will keep that unique. UPNs, unfortunately, if you edit them directly, you can create duplicates. And it, you know, what ends up happening is when the user authenticates, whoever's UPN matches their SAM account name wins. So it's a little confusing if you actually do that. There are some tools, however. OnRamp tool?
We have, if you've attended some of the other Office 365 talks, there's the OnRamp tool, which does data analysis for you if you're on-premises AD, the IDFix tool. Those are ways to find that you have bad data, but in this case, I think you're asking preventing it in the first place, right? Yeah. Disallowing.
The reason I mention those tools is they can be run many times.
Yeah, absolutely, on a regular basis.
We'll take one more and then we'll... Yes.
Yeah, so the only way to get hybrid mode features to work, Exchange Hybrid, you're referring to specifically, right? The cross-premises, cross-premises hold policies and all that, you do need DirSync for those features. So in the DirSync setup, it's one of the checkboxes, enable hybrid deployment. That DirSync is a requirement to enable those particular scenarios. Yes, the FIM connector will allow you to do the equivalent in the multi-forest scenario. The documentation that we'll be providing tells you how we do that. But it happens to be the connector technology is what can extract that information from the cloud and allow it to flow. That's why it's DuraSync or the connector. We'll definitely come back to questions afterwards, if you don't mind. We'll just kind of flip through real quick. How many folks here have two forests on premises? One that's a login, and you create a second one because Exchange told you to do it. Okay, so that's your case.
We call it account and resource for us.
Account and resource for us. Well, you don't actually need to deploy the connector to make that work. The connector isn't cheap. It takes time to install, configure, and do all that. The pattern that I want to walk through real quick is you may have multiple AD forests, but you aren't actually necessarily multiple AD forests in our case. What we recommend is you want to be synchronizing the UPN and the immutable ID information from your login forest up into the resource forest. I know I'm pointing at my screen here. And so with the UPN and immutable ID information now available in your resource forest, you can set up DirSync to synchronize that information to the cloud. From DirSync's perspective, all the right information is there. It doesn't matter that it's the resource forest it's synchronizing from. At some later point in time, if you want to be collapsing that Exchange, fully migrate into Exchange Online, then you can do a one-time migration, push all that data back down into your login forest, decommission that resource forest, and then set up DirSync against your login forest. So you've gotten away basically with a single DirSync installation instead of having to set up a complex FIM and connector configuration only to later on be able to suffice with the DirSync appliance. So that's something we definitely want to make sure folks understand is there's an option besides the full connector deployment if you have that scenario. I did mention briefly before that we do support synchronizing from a single forest to multiple tenancies. This is the department or the multiple campuses for EDUs. In this case, the DirSync appliance can do this. You just set up multiple DirSync appliances, each one dealing with one segment of the data from the source Active Directory. The key thing here is every object in your on-premises directory must only show up once in precisely one tenant in the cloud. The system will get very confused if the same, you know, John Smith object now shows up in multiple, and certain things won't work right. Email addresses won't show up, the UPN values will be wrong, so that's why the caveat exists there. It is possible in this case also, obviously, to have ADFS set up, because the source Active Directory forest in this case is where the ADFS would exist. And from the cloud's perspective, you're just configuring each of those tenants when you're federating to point to that ADFS farm. So it's absolutely a supported topology for customers now. You can also accomplish the same goal with the Azure Active Directory connector. If you have more complex logic where you want to be doing switching and things like that, the connector is going to be your solution. It works just the same. It's more complexity, but at the same time gives you more flexibility. Requirements for setting up ADFS and SSO, you need to be running Windows 2008 or higher. For DirSync, there's a couple pivots, so let's just run through these. The host OS needs to be server 2008 R2 or higher. The SQL server, if you're installing it against a standalone SQL you already have, needs to be 2008 R2 or greater. By default, DirSync now uses SQL 2012 SP1 as the underlying database. So if you're installing the default, it's automatically laid down for you. And in terms of the source Active Directory, you can synchronize from 2003 and higher. And all of these, well, both of these, support virtualization.
Just before we shoot past, it's probably worthwhile noting that we say ADFS 2.0 is Windows 2008 and above, and we do support 2012 for ADFS as well.
So right now, when you say upgrade, yeah, so what we're doing right now is the version we just released today is the baseline for the new upgradable DirSync. So to get to that, you have to uninstall the old one and then install the new one. From that build on, the one that we released this week, you can upgrade from that without having to do the uninstall. So the package that came out on Monday, effectively, will have SQL 2012 SP1, and we will manage that moving forward. So virtualization. The Office 365 team posted recently, at that URL, a white paper about how to run these two components we just talked about in Azure, what we call the IaaS service, Infrastructure as a Service, or VMs. And so what you can do is if this really meets your business needs, you can not deploy these components on premises anymore and install them and run them instead in the Azure VMs. What you need to effectively do is create that network connection back into the on-premises environment, therefore creating what we call line of sight, right? The components in the cloud still need to talk to your on-premises Active Directory. It's just the hardware running your components are now Azure VMs instead of on-premises hardware. So it's a very viable solution if you don't have the hardware resources on-premises, you're wanting to pilot, and just spin one up for a little bit, give it a go, and do all that. It doesn't really change what you have to deploy. You still need ADFS proxies for single sign-on. And in fact, because of the way that we have designed our components, you still actually need a DC in the Azure cloud so that there's a low latency connection from ADFS and DirSync to the domain controllers. We don't want to have to incur the latency of going from the Azure cloud to reach back on-prem. And the main thing here is what you've done is shifted your hardware requirements from something on-prem and now you're running them in Azure as VMs. It doesn't really change the fact you have to manage these components, or it doesn't really improve your ability to provide high availability. You still need as many servers as you would on-premises to get that high availability. It's just where that hardware is deployed. Real quick, how sync works. There's a couple of key concepts that we get asked about a lot, so I'll run through them here. The first one is what we call a source anchor. So this is going to become important as well for single sign-on. The source anchor is the link between the object and your on-prem AD, or directory, and the cloud. That's how we know this is the same object. So DirSync will be able to update that object appropriately. We stamp that when we create the object in Azure Active Directory, and it's actually used for the single sign-on scenarios as well. Key thing here is it needs to be immutable. Well, clearly, if it's the way we know this is the same object, you can't change it. If it changes, we'll say, well, this is a new object, and then you're a whole world of hurt because the objects don't line up, duplicates, all the badness ensues. So it must be immutable for the lifetime of an object. The second concept that factors into a lot of sort of deployment scenarios is what we call soft match. This is really our fuzzy match. I've started Office 365, I've created some users, they're using Exchange Online, I'm ready to set up DirSync and move into my production environment, right? Real users in the cloud. When you run DirSync for that first time, we're gonna try our best to link those objects back up. So what we'll do is we'll try to see if any of the objects from the on-prem directory already exist in the cloud. And that already exists criteria is, do they have the same primary SMTP address? We right now assume that email is kind of the most important thing. You don't want Bill G not getting Bill G's mail, right? You want to make sure the same person exists in both places. And so we check the directory in the cloud and say, does this user already exist? If so, we link them and stamp that source anchor. If there's no match, we create a new object. So that's a very important part to kind of move from an initial pilot phase where you create the manual in the cloud. I think Fast Track talked a bit about that this week, right? Getting people started, and then once you want to invest and move into a state where you have DuraSync, single sign-on. There's a question over there. That's a great question. The primary SMTP is only used for the first soft match action. So in this case, it's when you run that first DuraSync. After that match happens, we rely on the source anchor. So as long as that match has occurred and we stand up the source anchor, it can change after that. It's just for that first connection piece. Like I said before, right now what we do is we synchronize all objects. You do have the ability to filter out objects. There's an article on TechNet that tells you how to filter out by AD domain or the OU. Or user attributes. So if user principal name contains some pattern, exclude them. So that is possible. We do not synchronize system objects. They're not useful or meaningful, you know, in the cloud, so we leave those out. And some of the default accounts and groups don't sync. Domain admins, domain users, those types of things don't go. Directory synchronization can be turned off. Something that we often say is just turn it on and leave it on. It's a fire and forget solution. We'll tell you if something's wrong. Just leave it, and it'll take care of all the state reconciliation between on-premises and the cloud directory. You can disable DuraSync. You can turn that off, the box itself, and you can also deactivate DuraSync at your tenant level. So you're saying, I'm no longer going to DuraSync at all. I want to now just start managing everything in the cloud, that first column, right? The first column was portal. You can do that. It takes a bit of time, anywhere from a day to 2 days, depends on the type of object you have in your directory, because we have to go through and get that ready to go for cloud editing. And some of the things that can't be changed, which we get asked about a lot, so again, you can't decide which attributes sync to the cloud. By default, we synchronize everything that we need. You can't really go and pick and choose. The second is we synchronize every 3 hours. So that means, what that actually is we sleep for 3 hours. It'll grab all the changes, push those to the cloud, sleep for 3 hours, wake up, grab the changes, push the cloud, and all that. So that's something else that can't be changed at this point. And the last concept here is we now have support for sort of a recycle bin. Question.
Can you fire it manually?
You can trigger sync manually. There is a PowerShell commandlet called start online coexistence sync, which effectively kicks it. So if you're in the middle of doing some operation and need to get that to go, you can definitely do that so the changes propagate to the cloud. And then, yeah. Can you say that again?
In which version of DuraSync did you stop supporting changing the import?
So, are you referencing that back in Wave, BPOS days you could? Is that what you are getting at? Or? So, that has actually never been supported. It works because it's a test hook, and people have blogged about it, but it's not a feature that's supposed to be there. So that's what I was wondering if you're referencing, because back in BPOS days, people talked about that. I think that's what you were talking about, right, the information in there. So that's actually something that's not a supported feature. And that's why I put it on every tech ed deck, because I have to go back and say. So real quick, a bit about password synchronization. So it's just a feature of DuraSync. When you download the new DuraSync, you run through that configuration wizard, there's a new checkbox. It says enable password synchronization. That's it. No additional hardware. It's not a PCNS-based solution. It's part of the DuraSync appliance itself. Yep.
Back to that point about the 3 hours. It's fine it's not supported, but you're also saying that we can go in and take it manually every 5 minutes with a scheduled PowerShell task.
Yep.
From a user perspective and from an administrative perspective, 3 hours interval of updating usernames, that's not acceptable.
I mean, something we are exploring right now is decreasing that interval for sure. That's feedback that we've gotten. In a lot of cases, you might have sort of waves of things and you need to get those up quickly for students to start school or employees to start in a day. So we've definitely heard that feedback, and that's something we're evaluating.
Yeah.
It's a feature, password sync is a feature of DuraSync, no additional software, no reboots. You don't have to install anything in your DCs. It's just part of DuraSync on the DuraSync machine. For the folks in the room that are going to ask this question, we don't synchronize your password strings. We synchronize the hash of the passwords. In fact, it's the hash of the passwords that we synchronize. They're not something that, even if compromised, could be used to gain access to your on-premises Active Directory. That was one of the absolute design principles of our technology here. So how often do we synchronize? We check for password updates every 2 minutes. So just to make this clear, DuraSync is still synchronizing every 3 hours. It's still calling home what's new, sending that to the cloud. There's a separate password sync agent that DuraSync deploys that checks every 2 minutes. So it doesn't increase the frequency of DuraSync runs, it just checks more frequently for password syncs, because being able to log in is sort of the highest priority goal for us there. So it checks for every 2 minutes, and then it pushes those passwords to the cloud. If a user is currently signed in to Office 365 and we synchronize that password, they're not going to get booted right away. It's just the next time they're prompted to log in, they're going to have to use that new password. The nice thing about password sync here is, and I referred to this a couple times, the on-premises password policies now apply. If you have complexity requirements, special characters, must have uppercase, you know, letters, numbers, you set that policy in the on-prem AD, we effectively say, okay, we defer to your on-prem AD. Because we don't actually know what the password is. We don't evaluate the string. We just have the hash. And so that gives you the ability to be more secure now, technically, with the passwords in the cloud than you were before. We have very limited support in the cloud for configuring password policies. And so this is a big win for a lot of customers that want to have slightly more security. The implication of this password sync process is that user's account password is set to never expire in the cloud. So putting that to a scenario, if I have an on-prem policy of expiring passwords every 30 days, I go on one of my employees goes on vacation for 45 days. At some point, that password's expired on-prem. If they try to log in, they're going to have to change their password in order to log into their on-premises environment. That user could actually still log into the cloud with that same password. So that user account's password in the cloud will not expire. It will only change when it's been changed on-premises. So that's something I wanted to make sure I called out in here. The documentation also explains that. And the main thing for password sync is you can only synchronize passwords for managed users. So the users that are configured for federated auth, which we'll talk about here in a second, won't have their passwords synchronized. We will be posting an article shortly which explains how to move from federated authentication into a password sync state. But we don't synchronize passwords for federated users.
So before we get too far into SSO, it's probably worthwhile to describe it. It's a very overly used term. It means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And I have two views of it, the administrator's view of it and the end user's view of it. So from the administrator's point of view, it's a single credential to manage. It's managed on-premise. Okay, they don't have to manage it anywhere else. It's that single credential. Differs from password sync in the fact that there is actually two separate credentials. It is predominantly managed on-premises, but it does actually have a separate password in the cloud, as Jono pointed out. So there's a single place also for managing policies. So whilst password sync allows us to get to a point where the same password is in on-premises in the cloud, as Jono just explained, the expiry is a little bit different. Okay. In this case, we actually have a much broader range of policies we can apply in SSO because you are the identity provider. So from the admin's perspective, they can implement workstation restrictions, logon hour restrictions, anything that they would normally do to on-premise Active Directory are now applied to anybody who tries to authenticate in the cloud. And as I said, the IDP is your AD. You own it. If it's not available, you can't log on, which is one of the reasons we want a high availability solution, and the other reason that we say you need a DC if you want to host this in Azure. One of the reasons you might do that is for high availability. If my on-premises environment goes down due to some natural disaster or something similar, I can rely on Azure to be up somewhere else in the country, and hopefully that'll allow me then to be able to log on. And that's why you need a DC up there, is because ADFS doesn't authenticate you. It still relies on AD for that authentication point. From a user's perspective, they have a single credential. All right? If they get prompted for a username and a password, it's their on-premises username and password. They may be prompted more than once. Outlook is a prime example of this, where they get prompted to enter their credentials. Okay. And you can save them, and they'll continue to work until such times as you get through. But it's the same credential. The UPN and the password are the same. So that's prefixed my SSO statement with these particular items. So this is kind of, and I'm not going to read this all out to you, but it'll be in the deck, which you can download. But effectively, there's, if you like, three different sort of pivots across here, and if you like, three different client types. So you can have what we'll call an online identity or a managed identity. You can have SSO identities, and you can be on a domain joined or a non-domain joined machine. Okay. And in the case of those different types of credentials, based on the client you're trying to use, for example, if you're using a rich application, and here I'll be specific and say rich applications based in the signing assistant, the SIA, Link, online subscription, Office subscription services, CRM, and the Office 2013 clients, You'll notice that offices spread between web and rich clients. The 2010 being in 2007 are actually web clients. They actually authenticate as web browsers, where the 2013 doesn't. It uses the sign-in assistant. And then you have the Exchange clients. And the Exchange clients are really Outlook, ActiveSync, POP, IMAP, Exchange, Remote, PowerShell. If it starts with the word Exchange, it lives in the Exchange client column. So for online identities, you get prompted, and you enter your cloud credential. And it doesn't change because you're doing password sync. In password sync, you're still using an online credential, and you're still entering it there. If you're using SSO and you're on a domain joined machine, the column at the bottom, the sign-in assistant-based apps, domain join, corporate network, single sign-on, no additional prompts. Link is a great example of this. If you're using a web client, you get prompted for the username, and the username allows us to do realm discovery, and I'll walk you through this in a minute. You can tick the box to remember me, and then you'll be an integrated experience. So you type your username, you get redirected to the on-premise ADFS server, you'll authenticate there using a Kerberos credential or NTLM credential, depending on where you are. That authentication will succeed, you'll be redirected, no further prompts. Exchange clients always prompt for username and password, but it's your AD credential. Non-domain join machines operate a little bit like managed accounts, with the difference being you're always entering your Active Directory credentials, always entering your AD credential, no cloud credential used. So just some of the nitty-gritty details here of identity and SSO and the way that we actually work. This comes back to some of the Shibboleth and SAML setups. So all of our rich clients, so the sign-in assistant particularly, is a WS star compliant application. They use a SAML 1.1 token. We don't support a SAML 2 token with WS star at this stage. But we do have support for more than one provider. So we had started with ADFS. As I said, we've added Ping, Federate, Optimal IDM. Others are coming. There's a TechNet link in there. I didn't include it. It's quite long, which documents out the different types of restrictions that come from each of those. So I suggest you have a look at that. What we're trying to do here is add more providers to allow people who have invested in STSs on premises to be able to use those with the cloud services. SAML 2, or SAML P, you shoot me if it's SAML P, SAML 2 being the protocol. I am often called SAML 2. So we added support for Shibboleth, predominantly with the ECP profile. And that's because it provides an active endpoint. That active endpoint allows the exchange to post to it a username and password and for a token to be issued. SAML 2 by itself, or the SAML P protocol, is basically a passive profile in most cases. That passive profile only allows for web, and that's why Shibboleth is the first one we've got here. There's some other SAML providers coming. They're working on adding ECP type support to their providers, and then they'll be in that same TechNet article. But certainly things with like the sign-in assistant at this stage will be unsupported. So Link, Office Subscription Services, the 2013 Office clients won't work with a pure SAML environment, whether it be Shibboleth or one of the others when they come through. So there's three things that come in a token. And this is very important. It varies slightly, their names vary slightly between a SAML token and the way you configure SAML and the way you configure WS star. But effectively, these three things are quite important. So one is the issuer URI. Okay. The issuer URI is used to locate the namespace, or if you will, the domain, which in the tenant, so that we can actually verify the certificate of the token. This is one of the reasons we don't support token encryption, is because we have to be able to read the issuer out of the token. If it was encrypted, we wouldn't be able to do that. And then look up, effectively, the namespace within the tenant so that we can verify the signing certificate, grab the signing certificate, and verify that against the signature of the token to ensure that it came from the party we expected in the initial setup. So issue URI is very important, and it's globally unique. You cannot share the issue URI across many tenants. So before it was mentioned of the support multiple domain switch, the support multiple domain switch actually adds a claim rule that allows us then to format the issuer URI based on the user who's logging in. And we configure ADFS to do the same. But you can use custom claim rules to do that as well. The second one is what's called user source address. Immutable ID is another word that you'll hear it come through as. But it's effectively the source anchor that came from directory sync. And it's case sensitive, so capital A and lowercase a are two different values. So this is one of the reasons that we say DIRCSync is required for federation, is because this value is key. If you try and authenticate and you don't provide the same user source address or immutable ID in the token that is configured in the directory, the authentication will fail. You'll get an error basically saying you haven't been provisioned yet. And this is why DIRCSync and the way that we configure ADFS is such that the source anchor is used by ADFS and by DIRCSync to be exactly the same. And that allows us to ensure that this matchup just works naturally. If you deviate from that, it can become interesting when you federate the domain. And then, of course, there's the UPN. And a lot of people ask, can I use something other than the user principal name from the on-premise directory? Can I make it the email address? And the answer is, you can do all sorts of wonderful things, except for it won't work. And the problem comes down to the sign-in assistant client. The sign-in assistant client tries to find the UPN of the user, and it does that using standard NT calls, standard NT Windows APIs. And it does that. Once it finds that value, it will use it. Now, if you don't use the UPN to sync to the cloud, it's going to effectively do one of two things, either fail realm discovery or fail authentication, because it'll pass what it thinks is the UPN, and the ADFS server will pass it across to AD, who will then fail the auth. So we actually require that UPN be the value. So at this point, we don't support synchronizing a different value for user principal name. You must use user principal name. So just this is, if you like, a bit of a summary, and we'll walk through exactly how this works. But if you look at the different endpoints, so this is effectively the WS star endpoints. There's three endpoints. The top one there, the MEX, the metadata exchange endpoint. The metadata exchange endpoint is a WSDL document that allows us to figure out what the other endpoints are. So in fact, Link actually hits the MEX endpoint to find the Windows transport endpoint or username MIX, depending on where you are, in order to authenticate. There's the web or passive profile, which all of the web browsers use, and the Office 2010 clients use as well, to basically be able to prompt for credentials. It's a very interactive flow, if you will. This is the SAML equivalent endpoint, if you will. And then there's the active endpoint. The active endpoint is used exclusively by Exchange. And as you can see, all authentication from all the different clients out there, phones, Outlook, IMAP, POP, Exchange Remote Management, all of those use the same, basically send the same username and password in clear text, if you will, or basic auth, across to Exchange. They do it over SSL. They send it across to Exchange, and Exchange then proxies that information across to the active endpoint. It does so by passing some more information as well. So Exchange Online passes us three extra pieces of information. One is it passes us the IP address that it got on the edge of its network. So it effectively says, this client, however they got to me, through whatever internet devices they ran through, by the time it got to me, I saw this client IP address. That's where I believe their request is coming from. So it's effectively that external IP address of the client. The second thing it'll give us is the protocol. So it'll say, this was an auto-discover, this was RPS over HTTP, it was active sync, it was EWS, the endpoint that the client hit on the Exchange server. And then finally it gives us the device string. And the device string in this case is something like Outlook or, you know, Internet Explorer or, you know, an iPhone or a Windows phone doing active sync, whatever it happened to be. And that information is important, and I'll explain why in a few slides. Actually, very next slide. So what we do with that information is that it enables us to do certain scenarios around client issuance rules within ADFS. So if you have a restriction or if you wish to implement a policy that says, hey, based on rules within the environment such that Outlook can only be used on a corporate PC on the corporate network, obviously that's a difficult rule to implement. It's not something you can do with password sync. But what ends up happening is you now can create an issuance rule that says, well, I know what my client IP will be because I know what my external IP of my proxy is, for example. So I can say, if you're using Outlook and Exchange thinks you came from my proxy address, then I'm going to allow you to authenticate. I'm going to issue you a token. Or I'm going to say, no, you didn't come from mine, you're trying to use Outlook at home, and I'm going to deny that request. And we give you some sample rules. You can block all external access. You can allow sort of certain things. So you may say, I'll allow active sync from anywhere, for example. Now, to allow active sync, you need to also allow auto discover so they can configure the phones correctly. You can also say things like, I'll allow Outlook and I'll allow Oa and SharePoint, for example. And these rules can be combined together for different ways. That last one does require the ADFS proxy. Okay. Now, if you implement any of these rules, the way that we give you samples is they're deny rules. If it does not match this criteria, then deny by default. It effectively means that there's no granularity for limiting link or offer subscription or any of the sign and assistant-based clients. They will be denied simply because they can't pass the information that's necessary for the rule to come through. Now, we can do some magical things there, but there's nothing that we can do securely for those guys. So we effectively decline those requests. So how does this work? So, got to change that. So what we've got is effectively a client sitting on here, and this is our webflow. So the client goes along, hits SharePoint or Exchange, comes back and says, hey, before you can come to me, you must authenticate. Once I get to the authentication, it's a redirect. That redirect I follow, the browser follows, in this passive instance, over to the authentication platform, which then I type my username and it says, great, I know you. You're actually federated, so I'm going to redirect you again. And all the way through this redirect, I'm keeping tabs of where I've been. So the client then comes back up to ADFS. Now, if they're a domain join corporate machine, they'll be challenged for a 401. Hey, you need to authenticate with me. They'll negotiate down to Kerberos or something. They'll authenticate. The ADFS server will look them up in Active Directory. They'll get back a response from Active Directory. And ADFS will generate a token. And it's effectively what I'm going to call a logon token. And it has that UPN and it has the source user ID in it, or their immutable ID matching their source anchor. Comes back to the client. The client then follows that URL, if that follows me, follows that URL that it was back up to the authentication platform. We take that, we look up the issuer URI, we check the signature on it, and if all goes according to plan and we can find a user based on source user ID, we will issue an authentication token or an auth token. And we stick in there a unique ID. In this case, the unique ID is the cloud version that Exchange is waiting for. We take that auth, we come back to the client, client sends it to Exchange Online or SharePoint Online, and away they go. Right, here we go. All right. So in this case, let's have a look at what happens with the sign-in assistant. So I go to my machine, I get the sign-in assistant, I type my username and password, and I authenticate to the machine. My clicker is not the best clicker. What happens then, as soon as I log onto my machine, the sign-in assistant, which is running as a service, detects the fact that I've logged in. It then follows, grabs my UPN, sends it up to the authentication platform and says, hey, do you know this guy, Ross at contoso.com? It says, yeah, I know that guy. He's federated. Here's the URL details. It follows that. It hits the ADFS server. It passes up the MEX endpoint, parses the MEX endpoint, finds the Windows transport endpoint, sends an authentication request to that. ADFS authenticates an ID, looks you up. I couldn't put all these bouncy balls in there, it would take too long, and issues you a logon token. And it looks just like the logon token that the passive client got. No different. Contains the same information. Sends it back to the client. Client sends it to the authentication platform. The authentication platform looks you up, verifies the token, and issues you an auth token. Thanks very much. Then I fire off Link. And Link says, hey, you got to go to Link Online. Link Online says, no, 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 you've got to authenticate. And it just so happens the sign-in assistant says, oh, I know who you are. I've already authenticated you. Now, there is actually a little extra dance in here. We go back to the authentication platform with this authentication token. We have it re-signed for Link and then back, and then we send it over to Link. So effectively, what Link gets is the authentication token. So the dance that occurred is just slightly in a different order than it was in the previous setup. Link knows the authentication token and gives me access to Link. And in this case, I get no additional prompts. Exchange proxy auth, or the active endpoint. So in this case, I've logged into my machine. Nothing happens. Okay. Absolutely nothing happening. So sign in assistant will go off and do its thing like it did in the last one if it's installed. But the client has no effect on the way that I fire off Outlook. So I fire off Outlook, and Outlook says, great, I know how to talk to Exchange, finds Exchange and comes back. Exchange says, hey, you've got to give me some basic credentials. Take my basic credentials, I post them over to Exchange, and I issue, when I post them over to Exchange, I do so over SSL, and Exchange creates a proxy for me. So Exchange does the song and dance now. So Exchange says, ah, I'm going to go and ask the authentication platform, do you know anything about this user? And obviously it knows my username from the basic credentials I passed. And in this case, it's going to get back, yep, know that guy, he's federated. And this time it's going to pick the active endpoint. And what it does is it takes my basic credentials, formulates up a nice token, and posts them to the proxy, to the ADFS proxy. When the ADFS proxy gets it, it posts it across to the ADFS server, who then on verifies it into AD, looks me up, issues a token, posts it back across to the proxy, and Lori B, I get the same token again. And it's exactly the same token. It's the same one we had previously. Nothing changes, the values remain the same. When that comes back to Exchange Online, Exchange Online says, thanks very much, now I have that token. Takes that, sends it up to the authentication platform, because Exchange Online can do nothing with this token. Then Exchange, the authentication platform takes this token, reads it, pulls it apart, verifies the signature, and issues an auth token, just what Exchange wanted, and no different than any other auth token that's been issued. Comes back down. It now can do the lookup and find the mailbox for the user, now that it has the actual details to find that user. Finds the user, kills off the proxy, sends the data back, and the user is authenticated. So in all of these dances, if you will, the logon token that's issued from ADFS and the auth token that's issued from the platform don't vary. It's just you go through a different process of getting it. Okay. So recently we implemented, or we released, different multi-factor authentications. So we've had these for a little while with ADFS, and I'll walk through those. But what we recently announced was the Windows Azure Active Authentication. So this is for cloud accounts only. Right now it's for admins only within cloud accounts. And user support will be coming out in a preview soon. And if you want to look at this, if you sign up for an Azure trial, create a directory, you can tick a box and you'll get the ability to do this. There's also two kind of options, if you will, for ADFS. You can apply these to generically to any of the STSs out there, the last two. So let's look at it. So Windows Azure Active Authentication. So why go ahead and do multi-factor? I think this is pretty straightforward. You've got data, it's always under attack. Put anything on the internet these days and everybody wants to have a look at it. Don't ask me why. Passwords are pretty easily compromised. All right. You can, with Password Sync, obviously increase the amount of password complexity you have in the cloud. But generally, passwords are pretty easy to compromise. So, and then people starting to bring more devices that are out of the control of management leads to potentially more vulnerabilities in the system. So there's good reasons to want to be able to provide multiple factors of authentication. So we're using our Phone Factor platform to provide this service. It's trusted by lots and lots of different enterprises across a whole bunch of different industries, and it does millions of logons transactions each month. So right now when you do that, like my little animations. Right now, when you put this through, you can use, we're building out apps for this. You can use phones. You can have many phones associated with it. So if you have a different phone, if you go somewhere, you can use text messaging, or if you could, you know, potentially use Link, for example, if you integrate enterprise voice into it. So these are different ways of getting that token. And you'll see, if you go through the process of signing up, it'll ask you, hey, what phone do you want? And you actually verify that you've got that phone with you at the point in time of signing up for the service. And then you keep that phone with you as you go through. So it's a very easy way of having something I know, my password, and something I have, my phone or a device, that I can get the code, the one-time code, and prove that I am who I say I am. So from an ADFS perspective or an STS perspective, how do I get a similar type of service? And there's a couple of different ways of doing this. Firstly, you can use smart card access straight out of the box. It's something that's built straight in. But there's a bunch of different custom providers. RSA is one that we have an example on. Have a link there in TechNet on where that is. And you can also customize the ADFS logon page to do anything you like. So you could ask on the ADFS passive logon page, you could say you enter your shoe size, and if they enter the right value that you compare to something on premises, then you could let them in. Unfortunately, in these models, there's no support for rich clients. Again, these are sign-in assistant or Outlook's basic auth. And the reason is that it's very difficult to understand all the different nuances and provide some sort of capture dialogue for it. So if you imagine you're logging into Link and you have to enter your shoe size, Link's not going to know how to show that box that says, give me your password and your shoe size. All right. So it's a difficulty that we have in that area for rich clients. It's something that we're looking into, but it's going to take some time to get there. So how does this work? Let's walk it through real quickly. Smart card access. I start off, I try and access the application. It tries to redirect me to the platform, tells me I'm federated. Username, back to the IDP. In this case, it says, great, enter your smart card. So I stick my smart card in my machine. It says, good, give me the PIN. I give it the PIN. Then all of the dance works. I get back the token. I send it across, and I get access. Okay. So in this case, it's a very standard sort of approach. In the second model, where I'm using something like RSA or something that's integrated into IIS, I have some sort of 2FA service in this case. I go across, I add my 2FA module to ADFS, so it's aware of the 2FA provider, access the application, same sorts of things happen, I get redirected to the IDP. In this case, ADFS will redirect me saying, hey, you need to go and do whatever this smart card provider is going to tell you, or whatever this third-party 2FA is going to tell you to do. You prove that, you get back a little token from it, you send that over to the proxy again, it verifies it because the 2FA module within ADFS says, great, you actually did do what you were supposed to do. You get a response, and you send it off to the application. There we go. Again, these guys rule out. Both of these scenarios rule out all of the different rich clients, including Outlook, because Outlook, again, is posting basic auth, username and password, has nowhere to capture that shoe size requirement. The alternative is to try and work around the problem, if you will, by providing 2FA into the corporate network, which is, in some cases, quite a viable solution. So if you, instead of providing 2FA for a web browser, provide 2FA for the machine to get onto the corporate network, okay? So you can do that through direct access or a similar type of setup. And then you can use issuance rules to, say, block Outlook traffic unless it comes from the corporate network. So you can combine these things together to provide a secure means of allowing corporate devices on remote networks, VPN in, and still provide access to the services. In this case, what they're actually doing is they're authenticating directly against the back end. And because they're directly authenticating against the back end, if you like, the VPN tunnel is at the network layer, we can support those rich clients, because now they're just effectively using an integrated auth scenario to get there. So what does that look like? So we set up the ADFS proxy so it only allows Outlook. We disable the passive pages and those sorts of things so that you can't use those. If you're using your phone, for example, I go ahead, or Outlook, I send those credentials to Exchange Online. It sends a request to my proxy, and I issue a token because these guys, in this case, I would have had to have denied their, evaluate the rule, I would have actually denied them, sorry. So in this case, I would have denied. In the case where I now have a corporate VPN set up, the connects through the VPN, authenticate with 2FA, connects to the internal network. Well, we'll go back here. When I connect to that internal network, my clients are now not doing this dance out, okay? Now they're internal, they look just like they're on the corporate network, and I can issue it. So the 2FA factors we have here in Azure Active Directory are really around the first set being phone factor for cloud-based accounts, and the second set being your on-premise environment. So you, with ADFS, you get a couple of different advantages. You get the ability then to provide richer or your old custom, already existing 2FA solutions for, say, proxies or web apps. You can also use these VPN solutions to get through. And that gets us to our related content. Of course, we'll have the attendee party. There's a few. We included Ed's, this is Ed's sessions from earlier in the day, the deep dive into Windows Azure, into the graph directory graph. And there was also a session earlier in the week on an overview of Office 365. And we'll pause here and we'll take whatever questions you have for the next 10 minutes and 25 seconds.
No, that's a great question. Right. Yeah, no, so DirSync sets a predefined set of attributes, but it's not the entire AD set. We do have an article posted which lists for every single, well, for users, contacts, and groups, what attributes we are syncing from on-premises to cloud. Yeah. So the FIM connector is going to be posted to the Connect site. You know how beta is generally run for connectors? It's just going to be another FIM connector there. Happens to be that the Azure Active Directory is the target directory in this case. So it'll be the standard release vehicle, just like any other FIM connector.
Do you happen to know if it will move the password patch out?
That's actually a great question. I didn't mention this directly in here. The password sync solution we're talking about, which synchronizes password hashes, is only available as part of the DirSync appliance. We're looking to support sort of a multi-forest scenario for that, but at this point, it's only part of the appliance. Just given the very tightly coupled nature we have with AD itself, we haven't sort of made it something you could deploy just directly on FIM.
Sorry.
Are you awake? So the question was mapping basically from a single forest into multiple tenants. That was the scenario, right? So what generally will have to happen in this case is a decision on your part, to know which set of users, contacts, and groups should flow into which. If you're looking at the scenario with using multiple DirSync appliances, so simple case, one forest, two tenants, right? I'd have DirSync A, DirSync B. You'd apply the filtering criteria that's appropriate. So again, AD domain or the OU structure somehow, and really just chunk it out that way. Those were the most common, talking with customers, those are the most common kind of logical dividers people had, right? The other one was UPNs. For schools, there's a lot of students.school.edu, so that's another pattern that could be used. But it's really up to you in that case to decide how you want to partition that data, as long as each object exists in only one of those target tenants.
If you have an Office 365 subscription and a Windows Azure subscription, is that two separate DirSyncs that are required, or can one leverage the other?
So if you have a Azure subscription and a Office 365 subscription, do we need two different DirSyncs? The answer is no. It depends on the way that we're in the process of, if you will, migrating Azure across to be off Live ID, if you will, and across to the Azure Active Directory authentication platform. In doing so, what happens is if you signed up for your Azure subscription using your Office 365 account, you already have an integrated experience. So anything that you did in Azure will, or in Office 365 will apply to both. If you signed up using a Live ID, there is an article or a video actually on how to link these two things back together. So you can move from that Live ID effectively so that you can make one of your Office 365 accounts a co-admin of that directory. And then you end up in the situation where you can make, you end up with a Azure using the right directory, if you will. So it's really, it's yes and no. The answer should be no. That single Azure directory should be used across both the Windows Azure and the Office 365 platform.
And so the same answer obviously applies to any single sign-on infrastructure you've set up, right? You're federated with that tenant, which is used across all the applications. Very similar to how you might have it in your on-prem world. Okay, so back to basically one forest, multiple tenancies, right? The way that we've got this set, right? So DirSync is built on top of FIM. Anyone here who's used DirSync knows this. You aren't actually allowed to modify the DirSync appliance itself right now. So that's why DirSync is only used for a single forest, a single target. If you had the FIM plus connector solution, you could do that, right? You could have single instance of the sync engine with multiple target connectors. That's supported as well. But you can't crack open DirSync right now, add that additional connector in there. That's a violation of the license terms, basically. Was that the question?
Yes.
Okay.
What is the option for FIM connectors generally available?
Yeah, so our plan right now is sometime, I guess it is June now, later in June, we'll be going public beta. We expect to hit GA probably somewhere about 6 to 8 weeks after. It's obviously based on the feedback from the public beta, right? Like I said before, that connector is the same connector that's in the DuraSync appliance. So from a functional perspective, we know that it works. We've shipped it. We've tested it. And so a lot more of it's just going to be the ease of administration, making sure the documentation is complete. So about 6 to 8 weeks after is our target. And that's why the public beta and GA moniker in this case is a little misleading, because the technology itself, we don't expect there to be significant changes required, given that we right now have, you know, we have 12,000, 15,000 customers using DuraSync, so we're getting a lot of exercise against that connector, as is. The mic.
That one's not working, apparently.
When are we going to be able to see the next iteration of FIM? And will you be integrating DuraSync into it so that they're not separate downloads? It seems to make sense to do that.
Yeah, so the question was sort of when's the next iteration of FIM coming? I mean, as you know, FIM's constantly revving, right, iterating. There's the R2 that came out recently. They'll continue to innovate and iterate in that way. We are moving towards a world where you could imagine DuraSync is a very well-packaged and self-contained deployment of FIM. It's a black box configuration, but that's all it is. And the connector that we're offering is sort of opening up that box already, right? So I'm not on the FIM team, but we work with the FIM team extensively, and that is one of our goals, is to kind of make it so you could just build your own DuraSync on FIM. So that, I think, was the two parts, the question, right? When's the next version coming out, and sort of when do we expect DuraSync to converge with FIM rather than being separate? Eventually, you should be able to build your own DuraSync on FIM. All the stuff should be there. It's just from a convenience perspective, we provide this DuraSync appliance, right, which is all automated, and we do all the monitoring for you.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will be here. We're going to ask you then track resources, good things from office. I'm going to get to somewhere here.
There we go.
Is that looks like it? And then I think there we go. You can scan that to enter that.
All right. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you very much for your time.